Today at Reader's Corner, Pulitzer Prize winner Isabel Wilkerson, author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration.
This migration began during the time of World War I in the outpouring of people from the South to other parts of the country. It was not an immediate singular thing. It was something that unfolded throughout an entire century almost. So it's hard to see something that's that big. This was the only time that actually American citizens were forced to or felt that they had no other option but to leave the land of their birth and set out for places within their own country. And so it continues, the search for freedom, search for agency, search for being a part of the American mainstream.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. For decades after slavery ended, African Americans continued a mighty struggle against a caste system grounded in racism. Pervasive discrimination kept many blacks from building decent lives in the southern states they called home. Faced with few choices, they undertook one of the largest migrations in our nation's history, with more than 6 million making their way to Midwestern, Western, and Eastern cities between 1915 and 1970. Today's guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Isabel Wilkerson, explores the conditions they endured and the journeys they made in her New York Times bestseller, The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. The book is now out in paperback. Ms. Wilkerson spent 15 years interviewing more than 1,200 people to write The Warmth of Other Suns. In the book, she traces the lives of three representative young people who made the difficult decision to leave their homes during three different decades in history. The Warmth of Other Suns won the 2010 National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction and was named to 30 Best Book of the Year list. Ms. Wilkerson formerly was with the New York Times, where she won the Pulitzer Prize for her work as Chicago Bureau Chief. Isabel Wilkerson will visit Boise on Thursday, October 23rd, to speak at the Idaho Humanities Council's 18th Annual Distinguished Humanities Lecture and Dinner. To find out more and purchase tickets, go to idahohumanities.org. Ms. Wilkerson joins us by phone for today's interview. Isabel Wilkerson, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Oh, thank you. Great to be here.
And congratulations on this epic work. It's just a magnificent trail of a people as they leave their homeland and travel north. What is the dates, 1915 to 1970? How does one go about determining those dates? I'm sure a few people came before, some came after. What's the significance of that particular time frame?
Well, the significance is that this migration began in earnest and with a great outpouring of people, bigger than had ever occurred in the outpouring of people from the South to other parts of the country during the time of World War I. And that's because during World War I, the North had a tremendous labor shortage, and Northern industry sent recruiters to the South to recruit the cheapest labor in the land, which would have been African Americans in the South, many of whom had wanted to leave for decades, actually, but had not had the opening to be able to go and act upon their desire to leave, because ultimately they were seeking to leave a caste system that was so oppressive that it actually was against the law, for example, for a black person and a white person to play checkers together in Birmingham. The Bible itself was segregated, if you can believe it, in courtrooms in the South. There's actually a separate white Bible and a black Bible to swear to tell the truth on. And there was a tremendous amount of violence that attended the enforcement of this artificial hierarchy that had been created in the South. And the people began to leave when the opening arrived during World War I, and they did not stop leaving until the 1970s, when the civil rights legislation of the 1960s began to take effect in the South.
You call this great migration perhaps the greatest untold story of the 20th century. And now you're telling it, of course, in 2014. Why the large delay, so to speak?
That's such a great question. And it's a difficult one to answer. One way of answering it is to say that it went on for so long, in the same way that you asked about, the date of beginning and the date of ending. Of course, people are always moving about no matter what the demographics may suggest. But it went on for so long, it actually crossed over three generations of people. It was not an immediate singular thing. It was something that dragged on and unfolded throughout an entire century almost. So it's hard to see something that's that big. Another thing is that the people themselves had endured so much hardship and so much humiliation in the caste system that I've described in the South that they didn't talk about it. They didn't even tell their own children about what they had endured. They'd kind of experienced a sort of post-traumatic stress syndrome, and they didn't even tell their own children what they had endured. And so the stories could have gone unknown had there not been an interest on the part of the children of these people, of which I'm one. And so, you know, the children and the grandchildren want to know what happened and, you know, have begun to ask questions of their parents. And this book was an outgrowth of that effort to try to understand what they had endured.
So if you don't mind, could you tell us your personal story?
Well, I am a product of this migration. In fact, the majority of African Americans that you might meet in the North, the Midwest, and West, if you can believe it, are actually products of this great migration, because when the migration began, 90% of all African Americans were living in the South. And by the time it was over, 6 million people had left, and half of all African Americans were living all over the rest of the United States. And so my parents were part of that wave of people that helped to create, you know, whole new generations of people who might not have existed had there been no great migration. An example of that is, in my case, my parents were from different states in the South. My mother from Georgia, my father from Virginia. They left during completely different decades. They never, ever would have met. And I view this as a typically, beautifully American story, because most Americans are products of migration streams where their grandparents or great-grandparents, say from Ireland or from Germany, might not have met because they were from different countries, you know, far away, but they met because they came to this country and had the chance to marry people that they would never have met otherwise. And so I'm a product of that as well. And so are most African Americans that you meet outside of the South.
You mentioned that your parents were from different places. One of the things that really fascinated me that I never really thought of, even though I did understand the role of the Illinois Central in bringing African Americans up into Chicago, was the role that the trains played in this. Help us understand how where you lived in the South and what train line you were near then determined what city in the North you were going to end up in.
Yes, I think that's one of the fascinating things about how this population got redistributed all over the country. I mean, people arriving to a city such as Chicago or Los Angeles or Seattle or wherever they might be, you know, might not readily be able to see that the people that you're looking at came from usually a very specific part of the South. In the same way that any migration stream, you know, you go to certain states or cities in our country and you'll see, for example, in Minnesota that there are many people who are from Scandinavia. Well, the same thing with this migration, that when you're in a particular city in the North, you can almost tell if you were to talk to an individual, a black person who's been there, who grew up there, you will often find that they're from a particular part of the South. Because this migration unfurled in beautifully predictable ways, and there were three specific streams that the people took to escape the South. One was the East Coast stream, which carried people from Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, and Virginia to Washington, D.C., to Philadelphia, New York, and on up the East Coast. There was the Midwest stream that you referred to, which is the one that carried people from Mississippi, Arkansas, Tennessee, to Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, and the entire Midwest. And then there was the West Coast stream, which carried people from Texas and Louisiana out to California. So they usually were following the train lines or the most direct route to get to where they felt they could be free.
You know, my grandmother came over from Poland at the age of 14 with nothing but a suitcase and lands on Ellis Island. And when you think of this migration, it's exactly the same. Well, it's more than the same, because there's the racism element. But here's people who are doing nothing but taking a suitcase and getting on the train and leaving everything they've ever known as a way of living, moving to the North. And I thought the one little point you made about that Eastern trip and the stop in Newark, where some of the people didn't understand what the conductor was really saying, and they got off at the wrong place.
They got off at the wrong place because they're heading north from North Carolina or from Georgia. It's a long, long train ride, and they were trying to get to New York. But the stop before New York Penn Station is Newark Penn Station. And a lot of people got off at the wrong stop, the first stop where they thought this was where they were trying to get to, and ended up in Newark, and some of them decided to stay, and that's how Newark got some of its population.
Right.
This is, so many wonderful stories about how people make the decision to go, what happens to them along the journey, how do they get situated in the new places that they arrive in. I mean, all of that is in some ways very typically American, and I so appreciate what you said about your own grandmother coming in from Europe because at the age of 14, because that's one of the beautiful things that you discover when you look at any migration. Usually, it is a young person's endeavor. This is across all migration streams throughout the world and throughout history that usually people leave when they are teenagers, very, very young or early 20s, just on the cusp of life. And that's one of the things that is a reminder of the fact that this happened within our own country and that the ages of these people were about the same and they arrived with whatever they could carry in a very typically American fashion. As you mentioned, though, it was different in that this was the only time that actually American citizens were forced to or felt that they had no other option but to leave the land of their birth and set out for places within their own country just to be free. And that's one of the distinctions between this migration and others.
Of course. You're listening to Isabel Wilkerson. She is the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration. Well, in addition to the obvious escaping the caste system and the racism of the South, there have also been other reasons put forth as to why people would have left. One of them was the invention of the mechanical cotton picker. Address some of these other reasons and why you, I think, in your book point out that they really aren't as central to this great migration as some might have thought.
Well, that's a great, great point that you make. I look at the, the totality of the experiences of the people. I interviewed over 1,200 people in a casting call to narrow it down to the three that I would end up focusing on. And I should emphasize that the book is really about, their three stories to pull you in to the feeling of what it would be like to, be a person leaving all that you know for a place that you've never seen in hopes that life might be better. So that because there were 6 million people, there would be any number of reasons why people would go. And one of the reasons that has been put forth in the past has to do with the mechanical cotton picker. The trouble with that as an engine for this migration is the timing of it. The migration began during World War I, decades before the mechanical cotton picker had been created. The idea of citing that as a motivating factor is the idea that because cotton production was such a large part of the Southern agricultural economy that many people would have been leaving because they could no longer, make a life for themselves by picking cotton because there was a machine that was now doing that work. But as it turns out, when you look at the history more deeply and you look at the works of agricultural engineers who were looking at ways to mechanize cotton in the mid-20th century, you realize that the mechanical cotton picker was created as a reaction to the migration. There was not an actual workable mechanical cotton picker, out in the fields working and usable for and effective until the 1950s. By that time, that was actually three or almost four decades into the Great Migration. So there's a question of there's an interconnectedness, but it is often not what had been said before because the people had been leaving long before the mechanical cotton picker was out in the field.
And long before Daniel Patrick Moynihan became a U.S. senator, he was a sociologist and the U.S. Department of Labor secretary. And somewhere in his research, I believe you cite the fact that he identified the difference in welfare patterns, that if you go to Illinois, for example, the welfare payments would be higher than they would be in the South, and you comment on that as well.
Well, there were differences in the states, as we can see even to this day. Each state has determined for itself how it will apportion its resources to the residents of that state. I think one of the major questions or issues regarding the Great Migration that comes with this is the fact that the people who left, there were many assumptions about why they were leaving, about their backgrounds, but not as much a close look at their personal experiences as to who they were and what they were bringing to the places that they were arriving to. And only in recent decades, you know, really looking at the census data as it's become available in the last 20 years, have we been able to get a clearer sense of who these people were. And in looking at that census data, there are some really surprising facts about the people who left in this great migration from the South and went to these northern cities. And one of them is that it turned out that they actually were better educated than people had anticipated. They were more likely to have had some high school education than certainly the people that they were leaving behind, and in many cases, more education than the people that they were meeting upon arrival in these northern cities. That they actually were more likely to be married than African-Americans that they might have met in the small number that were already there in the North, that they were more likely to be raising their children in two-parent households. So there were a lot of assumptions and misconceptions about them that we're just now coming to realize now. In the course of doing the interviewing for this book, in other words, the casting call that I mentioned, you know, the auditioning of people for this book, I found that the people that I met overwhelmingly had been married. Most of them were widowed. Most of them, their children had gotten some education. You know, obviously life had not been perfect for them. They had been met with a tremendous headwind of resistance upon arriving in these northern cities. They were met with the restrictive covenants, which meant that when they tried to move out of the, you know, the inner city neighborhood that they had been forced to live in, the only ones that they were permitted to live in, it turned out that the white homeowners who might have wanted to sell to them were not permitted to because there were restrictive covenants on those deeds. And that there was redlining of the neighborhoods where African Americans were living, which meant it was very difficult for them to get mortgages or to get loans to improve their property. So much of what we see in the cities, much of the deteriorating conditions that people have lived under have been in part because of structural resistance to their arrival in the North. And yet the people that I met, without searching for any type of person, just going to the senior center that I went to, going to the various clubs that they created for themselves. You know, in Chicago, there were multiple Mississippi clubs that they had, and in Los Angeles, there were multiple Louisiana clubs. Just going to those places, I ran into so many people who were, to a person, at this point widowed, but had been married, raised their children, owned their own homes. It was not difficult at all to find people who fit what the census and research have now told us about who these people were.
I'm fascinated by what you were saying about what they met up with when they arrived in these large northern cities and the restrictive covenants and whatever else it might be. And I remember you talk in your book about the Chicago Defender, a very well-respected weekly African-American newspaper. Over the years, I believe it's still running strong in Chicago. And here they were advertising good jobs in friendly neighborhoods that awaited migrants. And I'm just a little puzzled. That's a black newspaper. And yeah. It sounds like they were more the Black Chamber of Commerce than they were giving Southern blacks the real skinny on what life's going to be like in Chicago.
Well, you know, they had their own campaign going to encourage migration for multiple reasons. One of them is that they were, by that time, a national newspaper, and they were building their circulation and actually took on, you know, this a campaign of trying to rescue African Americans from the deplorable conditions that they were facing in the North, viewed them in the South, rather, the deplorable conditions that they were facing in the Jim Crow caste system. And they were very hard charging in their reporting about the atrocities that were going on there, and took it on there as their duty to help get the people out. They even, once this migration had begun, set out, you know, days of exodus to try to encourage people to leave at a particular time. And all of this was, you know, sort of a kind of freedom movement, I guess, on one level. And on another level, it was a building up of the black population in Chicago, you know, which would have helped them as well. I mean, there would have been multiple outcomes that would have been seen as good for the people themselves and good for Chicago, as the Chicago Defender saw it.
Today we're talking about the book, The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. My guest is Isabel Wilkerson, its author. I've purposely stayed away, by the way, from the three people that you have identified, because I think each one of their cases reads like a novel in itself, except, of course, it's not a novel. It's really life and nonfiction. And I think our listeners deserve to read that without my getting in the way. But I do have to ask you, 1,200. I mean, first of all, that's a massive undertaking. And then get it down to three. How did you do that? What was the process you used to move from 1,200 to three?
Well, I did, you know, I did this casting call. So I was interviewing lots and lots of people, you know, going to a church, going to a senior center, and talked to as many people as I could on the ground, and then hear lots of stories and then follow up on them. You know, I heard all kinds of stories, people who, you know, hopped a train and actually got on the wrong train and ended up in Mexico by accident. I heard from people who, you know, left because the sheriff was on their heels. They're people who were fleeing persecution, about to be lynched. There were all kinds of people who left because they were following someone that they had fallen in love with. I mean, any number of reasons that you can imagine a person leaving. And I had the chance to hear so many stories, and in some ways they became kind of the tutors for me of what it was like to live in that era. And then to narrow it down to the three, I knew that there were three people that I wanted to focus in on before, you know, the whole purpose of all the interviewing was to narrow it down. And I narrowed it down to about 30 people, any one of whom could have been the three. And then after giving it a lot of thought and spending a lot of time with those 30, I then narrowed it down to the three by, you know, first of all, I needed one person to represent each of the three streams that I referred to, you know, East Coast, Midwest, and out to the West Coast. I also needed people who had left for different reasons under different circumstances. And I needed people who had come from different backgrounds. You know, one of them is a sharecropper's wife, and another one is a railroad man, a, you know, porter for the railroad who gets to see all kinds of things going back and forth, north and south. And then one of them is a physician who turned out wasn't able to practice in his own hometown in Louisiana and was forced to go all the way out to California. So I was looking for different circumstances. But in the end, I think readers will probably find that the thing I was looking for most was really characters, you know, people that you could, you know, people who were beautifully imperfect. They do not present themselves as perfect. They make lots of mistakes, as all humans do. And yet, you know, you're kind of, you know, you feel for them and you're kind of pulling for them and hoping that they, you know, they make it through. And ultimately, for me, I wanted people who had a good sense of humor, because this was going to be, it's a tough journey that they were on, and I needed people who had a sense of humor, and each one of them did.
You had some very fond memories of those various trips to the South in order to write this book, and I think one of them centers around Chickasaw County.
Yes. Chickasaw County is one of the parts of Mississippi that, well, Mississippi, I should say, it was one of the states where, you know, probably half of all African Americans in Chicago are, you know, descended from people from Mississippi, if not more than that. And Chickasaw County is a county in Mississippi where Ida Mae, one of the protagonists, was from. You know, she was willing to go back to the South. Not all of them were. Some of them had such really bad memories that they did not want to return to even visit the places that they were from. But Ida Mae, who was a sharecropper's wife, had, you know, was game and willing to do it. We drove back to her home county in Chickasaw County, and there we arrived around this time of year, in fact, in October, when the cotton is high. And we were driving in this isolated backwoods area where she was from, and there was all this cotton in the field, and no one out there at the time. And she was now in her 80s, and it had been 60 years since she had lived in Mississippi. She had hated picking cotton during the time that she had had to do it. They were assigned to do that because of the caste into which they were born, that they actually were good at it, that they had some special, you know, ability to do it. But she was terrible at it. Anyway, we were driving, and she said, you know, let's stop the car. You know, let's stop and see this cotton. And so we stopped, and then she, you know, she jumped out of the car. Here she was, 80 years old. She jumped out of the car, and she said, let's go pick some. And I was thinking to myself, I said to her, you know, this is not our cotton. This cotton belongs to somebody. We can't just go and pick this. And I said, besides that, we're in Mississippi. And she was just game. She was ready to go out. She said, well, they're not going to care what little bit we pick. And so we went out there, and she showed me exactly how they would go about picking cotton. We didn't stay there very long. We got just a few branches of cotton, and I still have the cotton that I picked with her to this day. And it was one of those special moments where she felt this connection back, these memories came back. Because she did not have to do that anymore, it seemed as if she was more willing to try it than she otherwise would have been. And it was a joy to go back there with
her.
That's
a great story. So you mentioned the fact that some of these 1,200 did not want to return to the South. Can we draw the conclusion from that, then, that the sacrifices they made leaving their homeland was worth it in their new lives in the North?
I would say that we should remember that they were not seeking to become captains of industry or, builders of skyscrapers, per se. For many of them, their goals were quite modest. They were merely seeking to be free of the oppression of the caste system into which they had been born. The fear that in any given moment, for the slightest misstep, they could be lynched, or that their family members could be in harm's way at any moment. And so they were seeking a kind of political asylum within the borders of their own country. And in that way, it was a mission accomplished for them. They achieved their goals merely by leaving, a sense of being able to have agency over one's own life, being able to have their children go to school for 12 years as opposed to 8 years, which some of them might have been limited to. Such basic freedoms that we now take for granted is what they were seeking. And merely by leaving, they were able to achieve that for themselves. Were they happy all the time? Did everything turn out as they might have hoped or dreamed? I would say no. The answer would have to be no. And part of it has to do with the reception they received in the North. And truth be told, we can see some of the ramifications of that when we look at the news to this day and see that we still have many, many, many challenges in the places to which they fled.
And that brings me to my last question, which is the dissatisfaction and the disappointments that they met up with caused some of them to reverse migrate. And I don't know how many. I don't know whether this is really anything worth a book or an article, but there have been articles about it over recent years. I'm just wondering if you could comment on whether or not that's the next volume of your book.
Well, a couple of things about the what I call the return migration. The return migration is actually of the children and grandchildren of these people, the people who migrated themselves in the Great Migration. Were less likely to return because of the world that they had left. And some of them, actually, those who are still with us, look with puzzlement at the young people that want to go back because they feel, we sacrificed all of this so that you would be in what they hoped would be the freer North. Why would you want to go back? On the other hand, we can see the effects of the response to the Great Migration when we look at any major American city in the North, the Midwest, and West, and we can see that there's still what is often called hypersegregation, that people are still hemmed in to certain neighborhoods or parts of the city that often may not get the same resources and services as other parts of the city, that there's still segregation in the schools. Obviously, there are, as we can see by looking at the news, there's often over-policing of the neighborhoods and of the people where they live. So there are many, many challenges that people are facing, and people who are the children of this great migration, grandchildren and descendants of this great migration may still be looking for a place that they can feel that they can be free. And so it continues, the search for freedom, search for agency, search for being a part of the American mainstream.
Well, that's a wonderful conclusion. And again, we're so excited that you're going to be joining us here in Boise. That's Isabel Wilkerson will be the featured speaker on Thursday, October 23rd at the Idaho Humanities Council's 18th Annual Distinguished Humanities Lecture and Dinner. To find out more and purchase tickets, go to idahohumanities.org or call 208-345-5346. Isabel Wilkerson, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. The name of the book, The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration.
Thanks so much for having me.
Next week, Adam Makos, author of A Higher Call, an incredible true story of combat and chivalry in the war-torn skies of World War II. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.